So for everyone who's joined us, let me just quickly introduce Dr. Paul Herskew. I'm sure most of you are already familiar with Dr. Herskew and his work, but I'll just give him a quick introduction. First of all, Paul, thank you so much for joining us again for one of these teleconference calls. It's been really generous for, on your part to really do these calls for us, and we really welcome you and really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us.
Thanks for having
me. Those of you who know Paul, Paul is really one of the top-level homeopathic practitioners and educators that we have in the community. He's a graduate of the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, Oregon, and he's been in practice now for over 20 years. He's the author of numerous books, including Homeopathic Treatment of Children, Pediatric Constitutional Types, the book on stramonium, and also two more recent books, which are very valuable, Provings 1 and Provings 2. All of his books are excellent. And Paul, in addition to his prolific work as a writer and as an educator, has also developed a unique and wonderful model that allows us really to increase our success in practice and really has taken homeopathy to, I think, a really new level. So I don't know what else I can say to convey what an opportunity it is we have here to have Paul educating us, because I've been a student of Paul's for 17 years now, and even though I've been familiar with his work for all that period of time, I don't think I fully comprehended how amazing his new cycles and segment approach was until a seminar that I was involved in last year in the Los Angeles area, where Paul actually demonstrated his approach with a live case in front of the seminar participants. And I really understood his approach at a completely different and deeper, more profound level than I ever had before, even though I had used it in my own practice. And so really, this is really a really big opportunity. And Paul, I want to thank you again for taking the time to join us. Just want to make a couple of quick announcements. Dr. Paul Herskew is going to be starting a new course in the Florida area, and that's going to be starting September 30th of 2005 in Miami Beach, Florida. And for those people who might, this is a two-year course, a certificate course, and for those of you who might be interested in getting more information about that, you can either go to the NESH website, which is www.nesh.com, or you can send them an email at course, C-O-U-R-S-E, at NESH.com. And also you can, if you want information about his Massachusetts course, which I believe will be starting up in the fall, you can also contact them at those same email and same website to get information about that as well. So, Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
For having me.
Okay. Paul, you had suggested the topic of this call to be the use of the repertory. And I know that you have some very strong opinions about the repertory. We've talked about it in the past, and you've discussed with me some of the things that you think are weaknesses in the repertory and some things which are advantages, and I know that your model plays into all of this. So I thought perhaps we could start by maybe you giving us a general overview of how you see the repertory in terms of some of the positives and some of the negatives.
Good evening, everybody. The repertory has always been a tricky part in our profession, where some people depend on it wholly and prescribe off the repertory, and whole cultures and countries use the repertory. And then there's always been countries that never even use the repertory. And with that, there's been many types of repertories that have developed through the years, and many great aspects of it, many difficulties with it. And without going through the whole history of the repertory, which I think is easy enough to find, I've always been struck by a couple of things. And I guess I should just go with history for me, which is just picking up the repertory the first time and just looking at it. And, you know, it is very easy to find the original construction of it, you know, mind, head, eyes, ears, like that. But, and then the alphabetical nature of it and so on. But after that, you know, I just started looking at it and investigating different methods of repertorization and picking up different repertories and using them through the years and repertorizing with different methods. But at a certain point, I got to the question of how do you teach this stuff? How do you teach it in a way that makes sense? How do you teach it in a way that is usable, that isn't going to take 10 years and 15 years and 20 years and isn't going to lead to errors more than help? And what I did is what I tend to do with all my work, which is take it completely outside the profession. So I took it to, you know, like different heads of businesses and different sports associations, basically people that are really good at what they do, at really good in their field. And I sat them down and I said, so here's the deal. I want you to tell me how to fix this thing. And then I sat down and I basically took out one repertory after another, talked about the whole history of it, talked about the man who wrote that repertory and the way that repertory was used and so on, and, you know, ended up with Kent and then eventually showed them the different computer programs and so on. And, you know, everybody was listening, everybody was pretty polite, and somewhere halfway through the discussion, they started looking at each other, and then they just started cracking up. And I didn't know what was so funny. I thought I just made a kind of a silly grammatical or silly mistake in speech. And I asked, well, what's so funny? And what they said is, you can't be serious about this. And which is why I go outside the homeopathic community, which is because we're so used to what we do that we sometimes can't see it with fresh eyes. And that's what I need, fresh eyes. So, you know, they said, so one person said, for example, you're telling me that a lot of this is your main book, this is your main database. And I said, yes. And he said, and there's multiple versions of this. Yes. And these things, these rubrics, some of them, nobody knows what they mean. Some of them are incomplete. This database is in kind of an imbalance to itself where some remedies are listed 5 times and some remedies are listed 20,000 times. That there are multiple ways of using this tool. Each use gives you different remedies and on and on and on. And, you know, as they were describing it, just sort of with a kind of dispassionate and non-attached way, I saw what they were getting at, which is that we have a kind of a problem with it. And if I could summarize it in a way that gives it a language, and if we think about it, not necessarily as homeopaths, just think about it as unattached observers, what you'd say is that there are two kinds of databases that are needed in our profession. One, and you can call them repertories, but let's just call them different types of databases. One is a kind of a database that stores every detail of every remedy. In other words, this remedy has cured this symptom, or this remedy has caused this symptom, this remedy has caused that symptom, and so on. This is kind of the Library of Congress of symptoms. And we have that kind of database already in the repertories that we use. However, we need a totally different repertory, a totally different database, which we haven't really developed yet or looked at, which is a database for homeopaths to find homeopathic remedies. It's a totally different tool. It's a totally different purpose behind that, the architecture of that database. But we don't have that kind of book yet. So what we have done is we've taken this database of kind of like the Library of Congress of symptoms and tried to adapt it towards our use, tried to adapt it towards us finding a homeopathic remedy using that database. And because it's not the exact purpose of that tool, and again, this is thinking about it not the way we tend to think about it, but actually just the way that the construction is made. Because it's not the exact purpose of the tool, that tool becomes kind of not perfectly designed. And so every homeopath, in a way, then tries to make that tool more useful, more usable, a better tool, a more refined tool for him. In that process, I try to, in a way, marry the use of the repertory to my concept of homeopathy, so that my repertorization using these tools will somehow mirror my case taking, will somehow mirror my case analysis, will somehow mirror my materia medica, and so on. And therefore, I've developed a kind of a method that I use and can use with every patient, be it an acute or chronic case, or first aid, be it a animal or a person, child, or an old person. And what I try to do is sort of address the main concerns of people that are really good in their professions. They said, look, if you're going to have a database and you're going to use these databases, then at the very least you need to solve for a few problems, which is you need to equalize the repertory so that remedies that are listed in like 5-10 kinds of rubrics will be in some way have a fighting chance with these remedies that are listed in 20,000 rubrics. And you kind of, in just addressing the multiple points that were brought up, I developed this system that I think is kind of friendly to the process of repertorization. Given that, I do think we need a more precise tool for what the homeopath needs, which is a tool to find homeopathic remedy that'll cure the person.
Hmm.
I don't even know what that tool would be called, but it would be a different kind of tool.
Paul, just to get some clarification, the tool that you're talking about that we need for the future,
yep.
Are you seeing this as something that's largely a clinically oriented repertory where when you look at a rubric that the remedies in there really have been demonstrated repeatedly to clinically treated that symptom? Is that what you're...
That's a piece of it, but it's actually, and that's really, if we spend time on that one, that's going to take the whole evening, plus the next night and the next night. But it has a bunch of things, a bunch of parameters involved with it, including the balance of different types of remedies to each other.
Hmm.
You know, so that some remedies are listed in just a few rubrics. How do you currently? How do you balance that out with a remedy like sulfur?
Sure.
You know, so it's not just clinical verification, but it's a kind of tool that we don't have yet, but it's a tool that somebody who's new to homeopathy can open up and find the correct remedy, which is a totally different purpose than the database that we have now.
Mm-hmm.
But given the database that we have now, we can massage the information to have a better use of that database. We can use that database in a more effective way and in a more general way so that we don't get lost in that tool, that tool serves us rather than the other way around. I think we've all had this experience where we go to different conferences and somebody presents a case and then you need to repertorize it and you have 100 people and they repertorize it 100 completely different ways.
Mm.
which is, you know, in a way you could say it's sad, in a way you could say that it's, you know, they've had an improper education or whatever, but really what it comes down to is that the tool is not 100% designed for it's not being used for the design, it's not being used for the purpose of that design. But given that we're using that tool, there are ways to make it so that those 100 people, when they repertorize it, will repertorize it more or less the same way, more or less with most people coming up with the same remedies. I mean, we had this experience in Greece a few years ago. I forget if I mentioned it on the last phone call, where Vasulkas took a case and repertorized it and had people repertorize it over the night and try to come up with a remedy. And, you know, there were 50 different choices. Nobody got the remedy he gave. And then we repertorized it. I had everybody repertorize it my way. And basically 3 remedies came out. And more or less everybody came up with the similar kinds of rubrics and similarly designed repertorization. And they came up with 3 remedies. And one of those 3 was actually the one that Vasulkas gave, which, by the way, worked wonderfully. So that's kind of like approaching a science, where you can have 100 people and they come up with, you know, a small handful of remedies, and where pretty much everybody comes up with a small handful of remedies, and for the most part it works well. I mean, that's approaching a science. And what's more, if you can teach that in a kind of a quicker way, so that it doesn't take the 5 or 10 years or 15 years that people need to become acquainted with the repertory. You know, if we can achieve that as well, that's wonderful. So, but basically, without going into that other tool that we need, I'm just addressing the underlying issue that until that thing is designed, we're always going to have some kind of difficulty with the repertory.
Right. Well, you know, Paul, I can say personally, from having used the cycles and segments model for a number of years now, that you're right. It really is a very elegant way of addressing many of the limitations that we find in the repertory, and from my perspective, significantly superior to just a standard numerical repertorization. So, having said that, and I think, you know, also when I show it to people, it's a very simple solution, and yet it really, as you said, massages this large database in such a way that we can actually make effective use of it. So
Absolutely.
Having said that, I thought perhaps you could give people an idea of exactly how this works. What is it that you're doing to massage this data in such a way? What does the cycles and cycles model do that actually allows us to, you know, put the smaller remedies and nozodes and so on and so forth on an equal footing with the polycrest and address the fact that we have limited remedies or missing remedies from rubrics and so on and so forth?
Right. So the first step is just to realize that the repertorization process is towards the end of the homeopathic treatment, towards the end of the coming up with a remedy. That the first step really is in taking the interview, taking the case, and eliciting the symptoms. Once you get the concept of how to do that, which is not just simply getting a host of symptoms, but in trying to find what I would call the real disease in the individual, then the repertorization process becomes what I would call pretty straightforward. And just without going into a lot of depth, because I think people can get that information from the previous conversation we had together. The concept I have is that there's actually one disease in an individual at a time, and that one disease plays itself out through a host of symptoms, mentally, emotionally, and physically, that basically due to the stresses of that the person finds himself in, through all the environmental stresses, he has to respond to it, he has to strain, and that straining one can see mentally, emotionally, and physically. And even though that straining is listed in thousands of symptoms, it actually represents one one strain. This, of course, is the philosophy behind the Organon, where the Organon discusses really just one disease. And the whole philosophical basis of homeopathy is one disease. On the other hand, the tools we use, which is the eliciting the symptoms and then looking at the repertory and then looking at the materia medicas we have, don't talk to one disease. All of those tools talk to symptoms. So somehow we have to sort of join our tools, which are pieces, to the philosophy of homeopathy, which is a whole. And in that process, what one could do is look at all the symptoms a person has, mentally, emotionally, and physically, and with a little bit of training, see that they all come down to a few major concepts, a few major what I would call segments, because they're all parts of this whole straining mechanism, and that this strain you can see in five or six concepts, five or six ideas that connect to each other, forming a kind of a cycle, and that each of these segments is then formed of dozens or dozens or hundreds of symptoms, so that you can take a remedy that has 20 or 30 symptoms and organize those symptoms in five or six segments, or you can take a remedy that has 10,000 symptoms and organize them in five or six or seven segments. And once you start looking at the patient and the patient's illness in this way, then we come to the repertory, and that's where the repertory should come in. And what I did is I kind of looked at the philosophy, and I thought, well, if this is true, then when we repertorize the case, we should repertorize it the same way. That given the tools that we have now, and especially the ease with which we have it on a computer database, we should be able to combine like rubrics. I'm not talking about identical rubrics, but like rubrics that represent the same segment and turn them into one kind of rubric, one kind of mega rubric that represents that segment, and then go to the next segment, do the same thing, the third segment, the fourth segment, the fifth segment, and so on, until we're done with enough segments that represent the disease process, and then see what remedy comes up. I think one of the people that's on this phone conversation is Bernardo, hi, Bernardo. He was in this conference in Toronto a few years ago where I treated a young man who was suffering from autism, who did very well on the remedy, and so we just did a follow-up, and he was still doing great, and I said, well, most likely he's going to go into sulfur next. And Bernardo raised his hand and said, well, show us the repertorization. How would you do it? And I said, well, to be totally 100% frank, I wouldn't necessarily repertorize it because I just see it this way. But he said, well, just demonstrate the concept. And then I proceeded to repertorize the case by taking all the symptoms we saw, which could be 20 symptoms, 40 symptoms, 80 symptoms, and then just organize those symptoms into this segment and cycle format, and then repertorize that, and sulfur, of course, came up. And by the way, he did great with sulfur. But what one achieves by doing this is that if you take four or five rubrics that mean exactly the same thing from the segment point of view, and within those five rubrics, one remedy is listed in five times, within that segment, one remedy is listed in five rubrics, and another remedy is listed in only one of those five rubrics, from the repertorization point of view, they've been equalized. They're both representative of that segment. It's equal. So I can take a remedy like sulfur, which might be listed bowl type in all five rubrics, and I might have another remedy like Azusa, which might be listed as a 1 in only one of those rubrics, and when the repertorization is done, the sulfur and the Azusa both stand, they both pass through. So that, in a way, what I've done in that process is equalize the repertory somewhat, so that the remedies that are listed with a low frequency have a chance, as well as with a higher frequency. The second thing that we did is some rubrics are, and this goes back to the Library of Congress concept, that when somebody says, I feel down. I feel bummed out. I feel down. Eventually, that's going to end up in the repertory, if you cure it. And if it's not clear, if it's not more clearly defined in the future repertories, it'll say, feeling bummed, feeling down, this remedy. If the homeopath clarified a little bit, you might find that the person said they were, they're actually feeling sad. And then that remedy would go into the sadness rubric, but the same person might have used the word, like, I don't care, in which case it might end up in the indifferent rubric. Or it might be in the ennui, or it might be in the weakness. So, because it's of the construction of the current databases, nobody feels free, nobody should feel free, to be able to say, well, he actually meant indifferent and sad. But he only said sad. And so what winds up happening is that the repertoire is being constructed very, what would you call it, with a very tight hand, which is very much important in this kind of, in a Library of Congress repertory. So that because of that, the same remedy might be listed in five or six different rubrics that kind of almost mean the same thing, just with a slightly different language behind it. So, for example, if the person says, I worry about my health, you know, somebody might say, I worry about my health, and it might end up in anxiety about health. Somebody else might be delusion. Somebody else might be hypochondriasis, and so on. And if you looked at a lot of these rubrics that kind of mean almost exactly the same thing, you'll find that it's not the same remedies all the way through. Sometimes 60% of the remedies are the same, sometimes 80%, sometimes 90%, but it's hardly ever 100%, even though they mean exactly the same thing. And the reason is that because they use slightly different words in different cases. And so if you use the repertory and you pick the wrong rubric, your correct remedy, even though you took the case correctly and they were expressing to you correctly, the rubric you chose might be incorrect because it doesn't contain the remedy you chose. You need to give them. And so in combining very like rubrics, you're able to accommodate for that error or for that tightness in the repertory. And it doesn't double the, you know, if 90% of the remedies are the same, those 90%, they don't come into the repertorization twice. They just come in once. And then the 10% that are different come in as well. And in doing it this way, you're able to accommodate for some of the errors of the repertory in terms of language. aside from that, there's the fact that the repertory is not complete, and so because the materia medica is not complete, because each remedy has these pieces, these what I call segments, and that each segment might have many types of symptoms that are exemplifying that segment. So, for example, the person says, what's an easy one? I have burning in the eyes and burning in the skin and burning in the bowels and burning in the stomach and burning in the throat. The fact that these burning, that it's the burning that's the general characteristic, the what the segment might be formed from, and yet the remedy they may need might not be in burning of the eyes. And yet they may come in complaining of burning of the eyes very, very strongly. And if you only had repertorized the burning in the eyes, because that was the main complaint, you might actually miss the remedy because you're looking at that symptom too tightly. And because the repertory too was looking at those symptoms too tightly. And yet if you had combined a bunch of those burning things together, those burning symptoms together, you'd be able to have found the remedy, because the remedy might have been listed in the burning skin or burning stomach. So in going about it this way, we're able to actually repertorize what I would call more effectively and in a more general way. In other words, that we can repertorize the same way with each patient, so that we don't have to pick, oh, this time I'll use small remedies, or this time I'll just use, you know, I don't know, just the mentals, or this time I'll just use the new symptoms or the old symptoms. And in a way, what this does is it takes us a little bit closer to the philosophy of what makes homeopathy homeopathy. Because ultimately, when you look at many people's repertorization, what they repertorize is not what we philosophically came to homeopathy for. It doesn't represent the whole of the patient's experience. And yet what I'm describing here, in a way, it does, because you're able to take many, many examples of these symptoms that they're suffering from and see the emergent quality that comes through them. Anyway, this is some of it, and it's perhaps a cerebral. So maybe we can just go through some examples.
Could you give us some examples? One of the things, though, I thought perhaps you could just comment on, which I've always found fascinating about your approach as it relates to repertorization, is that you don't end up with an endless list of remedies like you do when you normally do repertorization. You actually
right.
have an endpoint. I thought perhaps you could comment on that, because it seems like such a valuable thing
right.
that comes out of it.
You know, actually, I just finished the 90th letter of these letters that we write, and this one was a repertorization. It was a case, and I showed that the typical repertorization leads to this group of remedies. And like most repertorization, leads to a group of remedies, but the group is actually endless in a way. For example, a typical repertorization will have, if you put in 20, 30, 40 rubrics, will have 6, 7, 800 remedies that come out. You know, there's more, most likely to next likely to next likely and so on. In doing it the way we do it, we actually get to a finite number of remedies. And most of the time, the remedy you want is in that group. There'll be 6 remedies, there'll be 8 remedies, and the remedy you want is going to be one of those 6 or 8. Which is, I believe, the first time that we have this in homeopathy, where you can say the remedy must be one of these. And then you can get to the materia medica and just find the one you need. It's actually a much easier form of repertorization, because it just gets rid of so many inaccuracies.
Paul, I know that I'm very familiar with your work now, and I'm curious. I don't know if I've ever asked you this. How much of your work was inspired by the Bunninghausen Therapeutic Pocketbook, which was, I guess, the first repertory that really began to generalize symptoms in this way? And could you just differentiate what you've done on top of what Bunninghausen did in that book, or what you've added to that makes your work a little bit different?
I'd say maybe 15 years ago, when I would introduce the repertory, I'd say there are two people in this country that use the Bunninghausen method or have learned it well enough. Me and this guy named Andrew Lang, because of the teacher he had, who was a Bunninghausen guy.
Hmm.
So I love Bunninghausen's method, just like I love Kent's method. They both suffer from different issues of trying to accommodate the repertory to the tool of finding a remedy. What Bunninghausen did is essentially start the concept of generalization, and though he didn't know exactly where he was heading, and because he didn't know where he was heading, some of the generalizations are dead on, they're just 100% correct, and some of them are just so completely wrong that it's funny, and I guess the best place to see it is, there's this book that was written by Herring called The Analytical Repertory of the Symptoms of the Mind, which is his kind of repertory deal, published in 1881. And he kind of uses the language that will eventually be part of the cycles and segments, just like Bunninghausen used some of the language that will eventually become part of cycles and segments. The example he gave is, it's such a great example, is he says, in fact, I'm paraphrasing, Herring says, in fact, Bunninghausen is kind of right, and he's kind of going in the right direction, but he's also wrong in that he has no rhyme or reason for how he does it. And the example he gave is, it was carboanamalis. And Bunninghausen generalized the symptom aggravated by shaving. Which is, and this is just the point that Herring is making. And the reason he generalized it is that Bunninghausen had a patient that had a cough or something that when the person was shaving, the cough would be worse. And you'd have to go to the exact language there to find it, but it was more or less that. And so he generalized it. And then Herring said, it's preposterous, because an example he gave is, I think it matters whether the person was shaving himself, in other words, upright, was being shaven by somebody else, in other words, reclining. And that could have been the difference, that it wasn't really the generalization of shaving as much as the position. I would do it a little bit differently. I think it's different if you shave versus somebody else shaving you, if you need a remedy like calcarea versus a remedy like stramonium. And that's easy to tell, because, you can kind of laugh. Of course, somebody shaving you if you need stramonium is going to freak you out. And so what Bunninghausen started doing in the process of generalization is seeing like things and being able to say, well, yeah, this means the same thing. But because he didn't know where he was heading, his process of generalization would lead to 30 or 40 or 50 different generals for a remedy or for a patient. And many of those would just wind up being incorrect. And I remember when I was, the first time I went to Germany, in the early 90s, I said, at the rate we're going, we're just going to have to bring Bunninghausen back, and we'll do that for like 10 to 20 years, and it'll be a solid step sideways.
And then people see that that's just a stepping stone to the next step, which is trying to figure out which generals you're going to use. If you have 40, 50, 60 generals, which ones will you use in a case? And then eventually, through that process, you will eventually end up at a cycle format that will pick the exact rubrics, the exact general sense. The other thing that Boninghausen's method, though he himself paid a lot of attention to the mind, as in, you know, the main qualities of disease, the main qualities that you're going to look at. Number one, he said, the mind, the personality. What's come down is Boninghausen's method doesn't really use that. And even when he himself used it, he saw the mind and the emotions as a kind of a separate piece, whereas I would see it as a similar piece. For example, if a patient had an example, irritation of the stomach and irritation of the bowels and irritation of the skin, I would expect to find, and often will find, that the person is also irritable. So for me, that becomes one part, one whole segment, whereas for Boninghausen, that may be seen as two separate segments, in which case you may actually wind up duplicating some remedies and not having a remedy in one of those other pieces. So Boninghausen was heading in the right direction, just like Kent was heading in the right direction and Herring is heading in the right direction. The question is there a method that would combine all of those methods in a way that is not just codent, but that you can use with every one of your patients? And I think this actually answers that.
Thanks. Well, just to get some clarification here,
sure.
Between your approach and what Boninghausen was doing, to me at least, and that you can correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like Boninghausen would just generalize without really understanding the meaning of that symptom or the context of it in the case, whereas
He started the process. He wouldn't just generalize any symptom. He would generalize some symptoms, and sometimes he'd be dead on, sometimes he'd be just exactly correct, and sometimes he'd be just wrong. And he wouldn't see that some of the generals are actually the same thing, which leads to duplication in some respects and missing it in another respect.
Sure. But, I mean, Boninghausen would never do something like, say, desire sweets and then generalize that with any other rubric that had to do with, for example, desires comfort.
Right. Because for him, the mind and the emotions, while important, were a separate kind of general.
Right.
And so the nice thing about this model is that and I gave this example a bunch of times, you look at hydrogen, you look at oxygen, and you can study everything you want about it, but there's no way you can predict that when you put those two things together, you get water. Water is an emergent property. The viscosity, the look of it, the taste of it, all that is a emergent property from hydrogen and oxygen. It's the same thing with symptoms. Symptoms have an emergent quality to them. And Boninghausen was correct in seeing that. And if I can give words to this, he was one that said, we need to in some way bring the tools of homeopathy closer to the philosophy of homeopathy, which is a unity of disease. And because the tools of homeopathy were, you know, symptom, totally unrelated to each other. And what he did is he started putting them together, but as smart as they all were, they were all stuck with the times they were born in, and they just didn't have the language for emergent properties and so on. And so he would start doing this, and sometimes he'd be correct, and many times he'd be incorrect, but the if you look at where the natural progression would end up it will end up at the emotions and the mind mirror the body, just like the body mirrors the emotions and the mind. And if they mirror each other, then they should actually be combined into the same kind of idea, which I would call a segment. And then you start getting rid of, not only do you start getting rid of the 20, 30, 40 generals and start to see just 5 or 6 general symptoms, but then you start to see that these general concepts have a kind of a relationship to each other, that one naturally leads to the next, which leads to the next, which leads to the next, and all the way to when it comes back to the beginning. But he couldn't see that because it's easy to see when you have a handful. It's not possible to see if you have 30 or 40 generals. So when you, the thing that people who have been using Boninghausen for many years, the thing that they like about the cycle and segment approach is they can finally figure out which of the generals they're going to use. Because the problems they've had is, you know, which of these will I use? Will I use the right-sided? Will I use the 2 a.m.? Or will I use the burning? Or will I use the, what am I going to use? And so they get to that same kind of mix and match thing that the Kentian repertorization will lead to.
Very interesting. Paul, I see that our time, because of the unfortunate event of the lines going dead, I see that our time is running out. I did have a number of other questions, but I feel that it's important for me to give some of the other people an opportunity to ask some questions. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute the lines and let some of the other participants ask you some questions at this point. Before I do that, though, let me just let everybody know that Dr. Hirsky will be starting a 2-year certificate course. And I guess, is Amy going to be teaching that with you, Paul?
She'll be teaching some of them.
Okay, so, and also his wife, Dr. Amy Rothenberg, will be teaching. She's also an excellent educator as well. And that course is going to be starting on September 30th in 2005 in Miami Beach, Florida. And as well, are you also starting a course in Massachusetts as well?
We started the one in Massachusetts already, but we're starting one in Portland.
Oh, starting one in Portland. When is the date for that?
I think that will be in the beginning of October.
Beginning of October, fantastic.
Yep.
So if you want any more information about any of those courses, you can go to their website, which is www.nesh.com, or you can send them an email at course, course@nesh.com. And I can tell you from having been a graduate of the New England School of Homeopathy that if you're really interested in increasing the consistency of success in your practices, this is a very worthwhile course. Paul is a master practitioner, and his model really brings an elegance and an efficacy to our practice, which I don't think we've had before. So I highly, highly recommend it. Also, Paul, you mentioned your Nesh, the Hirsky letter, which I just wanted to mention also is an excellent resource for those of you who want kind of a home study course. It's a bi-monthly newsletter with cases and examples and philosophy and history, and it's just a wonderful resource. I believe is it $19 a month?
Yep.
$19. So it's very affordable and really a wonderful way to study at home and really get an opportunity to learn a very effective way of practicing. So let me go ahead and unmute the lines and let other people ask a few questions. Somebody have a question they'd like to ask?
Well, I have a comment in particular. Paul, you were referring about how these small remedies and small rubrics kind of get lost. And what I use in my work is that feature to modify the repertorization, the radar, to bring up the smaller remedies and smaller rubrics. So that kind of helps balance out the remedies that are more highly represented, like sulfur, as you were mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that certainly is one way of doing it. And I'm just curious, the caller who made that comment, have you ever tried the approach, Paul's approach? Just out of curiosity.
I'm still studying.
Okay, still studying. Okay, great. Any other questions?
Yes, I have a question. I'm wondering if you have an ideal number of segments that you look for, or a limit that you sort of put where you want to bring it all into a certain number of themes.
Good question. I basically follow the nature of the pathology. So, for example, the patient comes in, let's say it's a child who's violent, and you know the parents will come in, and let's say they're describing, you know, the parent has a black and blue, and they're describing that the child is violent. So I say, well, what do you mean by violent? And they say, well, he scratches, he tears, he throws, he kicks, he bites, and so on. All those are separate rubrics. So the question is, which of those rubrics are you going to pick? And if you take all of them and keep them separate, then some of those remedies you will have triplicated, quadruplicated, and so on. And some of those remedies will be only listed once. But if you take all of them together, as I would do it, you kind of equalize everything to that violence segment. So then I'll ask, you know, what are the situations that the child is violent? And the parents might say, well, when you say no to him, or when things don't go his way, or when he wants something and he can't get it, or all those things. And they'll kind of describe ailments from contradiction, or anger from contradiction, or contradiction aggravates, or intolerant to contradiction. And, you know, all those are specific rubrics, and you can take any one of those, but the remedy might be there or might not. You can take all of those and keep them separate, but you might have duplicated, triplicated some remedies. Or you might combine those into one rubric. And then you have this second segment that when there's a contradiction, there's violence, and the violence has these kind of qualities to it. And then what I'll do is I'll just follow it. Well, what's he doing that he gets contradicted? What happened just before that? And you might get that the previous rubric to the previous segment to the contradiction is very busy or very active or very curious, and all those specific rubrics, but you can make them a segment. And what I'll do is I'll just sort of follow it around until I get right back to the violence. Or I'll go forward and say, well, what happens after the violence? Well, we put him in his room, or he quiets down, or he feels sorry for himself, or whatever it is. And then I'll keep on going and asking, well, what's the next thing, what's the next thing, what's the next thing? Eventually come right back to the violence. The most numbers you'll get to is 6 segments. The most it'll come up to is 6. With those 6 ideas, you'll find that you go all the way around the cycle of pathology. In a well-taken case, you'll always find those 6. So hopefully
I think we have time for one more question.
3 seconds.
Krishna, I'm asking that, you know, certain states develop due to mortification or the broken down generally, physically, mentally, emotionally, broken down person because of some state has developed, humiliation, due to humiliation or mortification or something. Can we put that also as a segment?
If I understand your question, if they developed a new problem from the mortification, then, and that is the new complaint, then you would see the mortification, not just that it happened, you know, last month or yesterday or the year before, but that it's actually happening on a daily basis. That's the only time you can use ailments from. That really, it's not something that happened then. It happened then, and it continues to happen even on to today. And what you would hear then is, well, this person hurt my feelings, and that person hurt my feelings. And even in the interview, you'll notice that if you cut them off, you hurt their feelings, and so on. And then you're able to use rubrics like ailments for mortification. But even if you used ailments for mortification, which one would you use? Ailments for mortification, ailments from scorn, ailments from disappointed this and that. There's many rubrics that mean exactly the same thing. And so you'll have to decide between them, or take all of them separately and duplicate, triplicate, or combine all of those that mean the same thing. But at the very least, you would not take mortification by itself if it happened once. You would not even use it if it happened once, because it's not really mortification, which is the nice thing about this model. Let's say somebody is hurt, and they come in, they say, I was mortified and my problem happened ever since then. And you take the rest of the case and you find that there actually is no mortification today or yesterday or the day before. I can tell you for a fact, 100%, that the ailment, it's not going to be ailments from mortification, because the only way it could be ailments from mortification back then is if it's still ailments from mortification today. No symptom hangs by itself. Everything is context dependent, and it's even though there is a timeline to our lives, a state, a pathologic state, the way the truest sense of what the organon talks about is an ongoing process. It's a cycle of disease that goes on and on. It might have different symptoms expressing it, but it's happening today just like it happened yesterday, last week, last month. And the only way you can use a rubric like this concept of mortification is if, in fact, you can see it even today. Hopefully that made sense.
Yeah, very interesting. Paul, thank you so much, and I hope we will be able to persuade you to come back another one, since we did have that deadline for about 10
minutes. Yeah, absolutely. And if you guys can put the introduction to the analytical repertory of the symptoms of the mind by
mm-hmm.
Constantine Haring
mm-hmm.
and on your website,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe people can go to your website and just read that thing.
Oh, okay. And, yeah, we can absolutely do that.
And it's the paragraph that starts with, it was a great mistake of Boninghausen to separate.
We will definitely do that then. Okay, let me unmute and have everybody give you a big thank you, Paul. I want to thank you personally. It was a wonderful, very informative, very useful call. So thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you.
And can we give Paul a big thank you?
Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.